Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and today we talk about the crisis in Catholic higher education, and maybe more appropriately, the lack of a crisis in Catholic higher education, where probably one is needed. Catholic higher education tends to be accommodated to the secular society that surrounds it, and the Catholic college or university of today is comfortable in the world and often at great pains to avoid presenting the Christian faith in its fullness. Our guest is Patrick Riley, founder and president of the Cardinal Newman Society, which works to promote and defend Catholic identity in Catholic higher education. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And how long have you been at this?
It'll be 25 years next year.
25 years. So you came in the middle of the battle, really. I mean, Do you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. if you think about what has happened to Catholic higher education, in the 1950s, would we have still said that looks like that has full Catholic identity there?
Yes, we would, but the battles were already starting as early as that and even earlier.
Okay. And so what are the landmarks in that journey from there to here? And one would assume that the revolutions of the 1960s, including the sexual revolution, certainly the Second Vatican Council, all of those things must be contributing factors. But what happened in Catholic higher education?
Yeah, they were contributing factors, although there are reasons why those happened in the first place, right?
So yes.
As early as the 1930s, 1940s, there were major discussions and battles going on internally at places like Catholic University of America. Archbishop Fulton Sheen, I was reading his biography, and he actually had made several presentations to the Board of Trustees arguing against this mentality of we need to be a Catholic Harvard. You know, the idea was
need
to go to that German model. And, of course, Catholic U was especially tempted since it was primarily a graduate school for most of its history. So this was going on for a long time. John Tracy Ellis was involved with it. You know, a lot of major intellectual figures of the 30s and 40s mm-hmm. and into the 50s were engaged in this discussion about where Catholic higher education needs to go, and this whole idea of assimilating and accommodating to the culture. You know, do we accommodate to it or can we convert it? And I think in those days, you know, the new evangelization was not on their radar the way it is today.
Right. So the student who experienced Catholic higher education in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it would have been something different in each of those decades. There was kind of a progress of secularization, wouldn't
That's
you
right.
say?
That's right.
And we hear about the Land O'Lakes Conference. Could you tell me what that is and why it happened and what its consequences were?
Sure. Well, the importance of it is really it was a watershed moment. It was sort of the point at which everything started to really tip and fall over. It was led by Father Ted Hesburgh, who was very influential president of Notre Dame. But also, more importantly, with regard to the conference, he was the president of the International Federation of Catholic Universities, which is a Vatican sponsored organization. And the thought was at the time that they needed to get a grip on what exactly is a Catholic university and what's the idea of a Catholic university. So these are the early stages of what later became Ex Corde Ecclesiae in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also surrounding the whole, you know, they were gearing up for a change in canon law in 1983, the Code of Canon Law. It was actually the first time in the history of the church that the Code of Canon Law recognized that we have higher education.
Oh, really? It wasn't recognized in law before
that? It was never mentioned in the law. And so this was all sort of an awakening to what does it mean to be a Catholic university. And Father Hesburgh gathered a number of his pretty close friends. It was actually a very small gathering. There were only a few institutions from the U.S. and a few from Canada and some others from Latin America. And they got together as the North American contingent to put together a draft of a document that eventually was going to be issued by the entire International Federation. The final document that the International Federation put out is very good. In fact, Ex Corde Ecclesiae, which we can talk about later, but the Apostolic Constitution on Catholic Universities issued by St. John Paul actually heavily cites the International Federation's document. But the Land of Lakes statement, as it was popularly called, was the statement that the North American scholars put together.
I see. So it wasn't adopted by the international organization.
Not in whole. I think there were influences, and certainly Father Hesburgh, being the president of the International Federation, was very influential. But the Vatican had to push back pretty strongly against the tendencies of Land O'Lakes.
At this time, too, did the fact that following the Second Vatican Council and, again, all the revolutions of the 1960s or as those things progressed, there was a pretty steady and even at one point catastrophic loss of priests, sisters, brothers. Did the loss of those in the universities affect what was going on in the universities?
I think so, although I think the bigger problem was the corruption within the orders, right? I think in some ways, you know, a number of these institutions run by religious orders would have been better off if the religious had left.
I see.
Because that's where a lot of the influence was pushing the changes from the religious. You know, there was, the Jesuits and a number of the other orders, the women's religious orders, and a lot of changes were happening. And it was all in reaction to, certainly, to Humanae Vitae and Vatican II, and all of this was happening all at once.
Right.
And essentially what happened is, so the Land O'Lakes statement was, in effect, the Declaration of Independence from the Church. It was essentially saying that a Catholic university must be independent of the hierarchy of the Church, that in order to be a genuine intellectual higher education institution, they must have complete autonomy. They said complete autonomy from authority of any kind, lay or clerical, and that the meaning was very clear, that they were saying that the Church has no authority over the university. Now, was that intended to say we are no longer Catholic? Not at all. And Father Hesburgh talked about it later and said, you know, that was not at all our intention. But we know as individuals, you know, the further we walk away from the institutional Church, the further we walk away from sacrament and from hierarchy and respect for the authority of the Church, at least over, you know, faith and morals, it's hard and eventually impossible to be truly Catholic. And so that's what's happened in higher education, is this lack of respect for the Church, even on faith and morals.
So you're saying on Catholic campuses, we might find a lack of respect for the bishops, for example?
Yeah, I think it's almost more palpable in many of our higher education institutions than it is anywhere else in the Church, right? And to some extent, it was certainly influenced by the direction that the culture was going and the general problems in the Church. But I think it's fair to say that many of the academics within our Catholic institutions were leaders in that push and the confusion that occurred after Vatican II. I mean, they were part of the cause of it.
Do you think that it's part of maybe the nature of a university and because of its academic and exploratory nature of what goes on at a university, that whenever there's – maybe there's no rule here, but it seems like it's understandable that where there's a liberalizing force that's battling a – more stabilizing or conserving force, that they're going to go with the liberalizing force, and that's what happened. Is that really this is all part of a deep divide that happened in the Catholic mind in the 60s and 70s?
Right. You know, I think that's true, but I think we know as Catholics that I think it's human nature in the absence of faith to always lean toward the liberalizing force, right?
I see.
But
to
when
change.
You have that strong faith, and you see the joy of conforming, right? The joy of obedience and the joy of and love of what the Church provides, then you don't have that problem. And so clearly, there was a crisis of faith. I mean, the crisis in higher education is at its root a crisis of faith.
So if the Land O'Lakes conference and things like it of that time tended in the degree of kind of disintegration and disassociation. That is, we instead of being an integrated part of the diocese of the local Church, but to be separated from that and be entirely independent. If it went too far in that direction, which it clearly seems to have done, where would you say is the healthy line? Reflecting back now, we have the benefit of hindsight. What is a healthy state of independence and yet integration for a Catholic higher education institution?
Well, Ex Cordia Ecclesiae really wrestles with that, this idea of institutional autonomy. The fact is, if we look today at the state of Catholic higher education and what's resulted, the institutions, about 10% of the institution of our Catholic higher education institutions, are really just solidly Catholic.
Okay.
And by and large, these are lay-run, lay-infused institutions. I mean, these are not institutions controlled by the church in the way that we would have thought in the 1950s. And in fact, it would have been unimaginable that they would have had the kind of autonomy that they have today in terms of their institutional practices. So St. John Paul II actually embraced that idea that there is a certain institutional autonomy, just like there's individual autonomy. The bishop does not tell me how to pay my bills. The bishop does not tell me even how to make a choice in terms of where I give my money. However, the bishop will advise me in terms of faith and morals, what is appropriate and what are appropriate standards for doing those sorts of things. And and it's something that, frankly, I think has been worked out since Vatican II in a way that you know, we tend to look at all the problems, but there are a lot of healthy developments that have occurred because of these challenges. And
right.
And this is one, this idea of a college or university or any apostolate, Catholic Answers, Cardinal Newman Society, has a certain institutional autonomy to make internal decisions. And the function, however, we do have, the church has a right to assent to faith and morals and certainly a respect for the hierarchy that probably, you know, around the edges even goes beyond that, right? You know, if the bishop asks me to do something that maybe he doesn't have the direct authority to insist that I do it out of love for the church and love for my bishop and understanding that he is trying to do something good for the church. And that should be the attitude, the approach of these colleges and universities. And we certainly see that with a number of the newer institutions and the ones that have reformed, how they, you know, they're very close to their bishops and they love to serve them.
So Ex Cordia Ecclesiae, we've mentioned it several times. But in the course of this decades-long kind of struggle for the soul of the church and of the institutions within the church, particularly as we're discussing Catholic higher education, Ex Cordia Ecclesiae, a document from Pope John Paul II, It had provisions that were not let's say it came out, it was controversial when it came out.
They were.
I
mean, the very idea of an apostolic constitution on Catholic universities was controversial because so we had the 1983 Code of Canon Law, and then immediately after that, the Vatican got to work, and it took a while until the late 70s, on an apostolic constitution governing ecclesiastical faculty, right? So these are the ones that the Vatican directly charters, directly controls.
Yes, I see. Right.
Excuse me. And these were, you know, clearly that made sense. But already at that time, there were rumblings, especially in the American higher education community, that maybe the Vatican is thinking of doing this more generally for Catholic colleges, and there was already sort of these warning shots sent over to the Vatican saying, you can't do this, this isn't appropriate, we're completely autonomous, we're under no authority of the church. And so that's where, you know, again, St. John Paul II sort of threaded that line and made it clear that, yes, you have institutional autonomy, but no, you're all under the church. The other controversy after, between 1983 with the Code of Canon Law and when Ex Cordia Ecclesiae was issued in 1990, was this the canon lawyers, especially in the United States, almost unanimously were saying that Catholic colleges and universities in the United States are not under canon law. And that's because they're not legally owned by the church. And therefore, they're not canonically responsible for adhering to the statutes and canon law. And so St. John Paul II, with Ex Cordia Ecclesiae, came out very clearly and said, no, any institution that identifies itself as Catholic does come under canon law and must have has institutional autonomy, but also must have an institutional commitment to the Catholic faith.
See, that brings up a point that I think a lot of people today are frustrated with, this idea that we're autonomous and no one has a right to tell us what to do, and yet we get to say that we're Catholic. This seems like in some cases, frankly, it seems like just false advertising. No, you're saying, you're just using that word because it has a certain feeling that goes with it. It raises a certain amount of money. It makes parents comfortable because they believe in Catholic education. But if you say, I'm Catholic, but I have no ties to the Catholic Church, what does that even mean? It seems false to me.
Sure. And it absolutely is false, right? It absolutely is. Our faith is sacramental. Our religion is sacramental. I mean, you cannot divorce yourself from the church. And so that's what has led to then all these other problems with these institutions, because unless there's an appropriate authority, and I'm using authority in the broader sense, right, of it's not necessarily that that we need people to go in and nanny these schools, although in some cases I think we do, or to dictate, but there is authority, right, as an understanding that there is a proper location of the truth in this particular matter, and in faith and morals, that's in the church. It's not, it cannot possibly be within the academic institution.
And so, but Ex Cordia Ecclesia can't just, it's not just the Pope saying, well, it turns out you are, if you're going to go around calling yourself Catholic and saying this is the Catholic education, you do fall under the canon law of the church and under, at least to some degree, the jurisdiction of the magisterium. He also presents there, and in addition to you having that obligation, here's what Catholic education should look like. Mm-hmm. So what are the things that he says Catholic education should contain?
He does. In some ways, I wish he had done more. But, I think it was a great start in terms of setting out the vision. And I suppose, again, you run the risk of dictating things that maybe it's not the church's role to dictate. And
yes,
so he was right, being careful on that. But, he made it very clear that in order to be Catholic, a Catholic college or university must, at a minimum, have at least half of their faculty Catholic.
Okay.
So you can't maintain a Catholic ethos. You can't maintain a conversation
right
within all the various disciplines about Catholic things if people don't know it. It's just simply.
So you might say you have a wonderful, I don't know, evangelical Bible scholar, or you have a wonderful Jewish, physicist or something. I don't hope I'm not being stereotypical, but see what, right. But these things, these people are welcome and they should be teachers, but you need a certain critical mass of Catholic faithful,
right,
employed by the university to say it really is a community of Catholics.
Right. And 50% was, my understanding is that there was a lot of wrestling with, here they are actually putting out a bright line. And I think the instinct at the Vatican was actually to have it much higher. But the idea was, let's put it at this level, because they're not just looking at institutions in the United States. They're looking at Catholic universities in China.
Oh,
right. Where
yeah,
to get 50% Catholic faculty is very difficult, even if you have all the intentions of having a thoroughly Catholic institution.
Right.
In the United States, there's absolutely no excuse for having anywhere close to 50%. I mean, it ought to be much, much higher. Unfortunately, over the last few decades, many institutions, including some that are even recommended in our Newman Guide, allow the faculty to slowly dissipate in terms of the percentage that were Catholic. And getting that back up is a very difficult process.
Yeah.
Because part of what's happening is that all the older faculty are Catholic. So everyone who retires, you'd have to replace them one for one
with
Catholics,
yeah,
in order just to maintain your current percentage.
I see.
And so there are institutions like the Catholic University of America where there is a very concerted effort to increase the number of Catholics on the faculty. And that just takes time. It's a hard process.
Okay. So if item one is faculty should mm-hmm. be Catholic, at least 50%, but
right,
but ideally more in right order to maintain that Catholic community, what's item number two?
So yeah, that was probably the most controversial one. So uh-huh, I'll bring that up first. There is discussion about the integration of disciplines. Okay. So this goes back to Newman, John Henry Newman,
yeah,
this idea that all truth is related. It makes sense to have disciplines in order to structure how we study things, but especially when it comes to the truths of our faith, that they bear upon absolutely every form of study.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing a lot of work on this in the K-12 arena, and I'd like to start seeing more of this being discussed in the higher education arena. You know, what does it mean to study math at a Catholic university? It doesn't mean that there is a Catholic math, but it does mean that someone coming out of a Catholic institution ought to have an understanding of mathematics as not simply a formulaic system that Newton or somebody else came up with. No, it's a reflection of the world. It's a reflection of creation and the order in creation. Mm-hmm. It's one of the greatest proofs of God, right, is mathematics. And
right.
yet that's often not even addressed in a Catholic university. And these are the sorts of things that ought to creep into every study of discipline or every discipline. History, of course, I mean, we've lost so much of our understanding of Catholic history, in part because, especially in the U.S., you know, we've had a domination of education by Protestant education. There used to be a real conflict, I suppose, you know, between the Protestants and the Catholics in terms of control of education. And so a lot of our history, especially, has excluded much of what is really important to history. It's not that it's a Catholic history. It's history.
Yes.
And right. And this needs to be studied. And so there's a lot of work already being done to recover that. So that's really exciting. And he really pushed that, not just in Ex Corde, but of course in Veritas Splendor and his other writings.
So that must mean that the teaching of theology, which is the science that orders all the other sciences, that in which they can all find their proper home,
mm-hmm.
for ultimate reflection, that must be a big part of what has to go on at a Catholic university.
You know, that's something of a modern concept. You know, Newman actually said, you don't even have to teach theology,
really?
At a Catholic university, but it has to inform everything that you teach.
Yeah.
And so what St. John Paul II said in Ex Corde Ecclesiae is that any Catholic institution, in order to be Catholic, ought to at least have a chair of theology. So that could be one person within the institution who is helping to ensure that when theological subjects are addressed, there's sort of a check on that and making sure that they're being addressed properly. Of course, you know, as we know today, you have to make sure that your theologian is an appropriate theologian actually doing theology and not explorative Protestant new theology or something.
Right. Okay. So, what any more that the Pope tells us that are essentials of a Catholic higher education institution?
There's one line that's almost buried it's in the norms, but where he comes right out and he says that a Catholic university needs to, I'm trying to remember the exact wording, but in all of its activities and its commitments needs to uphold its Catholic identity. So it's sort of that catch-all phrase that, of course, we refer to very often, that goes back into things like student life and dorm situations and activities and speakers and all these things where you wrestle with these decisions about how to do things. And it always comes back to that if you're not doing it with a sense of promoting the truth, mm-hmm. and the truth that we know, or worse, that you're doing something that contradicts truth, yeah. and leads someone away from truth, that's not the purpose of a university. And you know, everyone screams today about censorship and free speech and all of this. And of course, free speech, free dialogue, debate, all of this are extremely important in every discipline to come to an understanding of it, even in theology, to have that discussion.
Right.
But in theology and as Catholics at a Catholic institution, we place a marker and we say, by faith, others may not agree with this, but by faith we assent to what Christ has taught us and what the church, what Christ through the church teaches us. And therefore, that's truth. And it's not one of those things that you get to by dialogue and discussion, you know, the essential truths. You can discuss how to understand it and how to apply it.
Right, but we believe
ethical
something.
Discussions, that's, but we believe something. And that's a foundation for a Catholic university. Yeah. And that's what distinguishes them.
Well, one of the things that I see, which it strikes me as kind of a rhetorical kind of, I don't know, flourish really or something. People will say Catholic identity, they'll put in the mission statement, Catholic identity and all that. And if you say, well, what are you doing to promote Catholic identity to some of these universities? And they do in fact say this, well, we have this ethics in the university program and but you want to say, okay, I'm not hearing the name of Christ. I'm not hearing anything about we communicate the person of Christ. Ethics is, everybody's got ethics. Like, why does that make you Catholic? So what is the obligation of the university in evangelizing, catechizing, and theologizing about Christ?
Yeah, So what is the obligation? Pope John Paul II starts right out at the beginning saying that what distinguishes the Catholic University is that it is consecrated to truth. The truth is the fundamental purpose, objective, and foundation at the same time of the institution, right? And so we rest on truth and we seek truth at the same time. And that is the purpose of the university. And anything that conflicts with that is problematic. And so, we assent to certain truths because Christ told us that, and we have no other way of coming to those truths. We either assent to it or we deny it.
Right.
It's one or the other. Truths about God that are mysteries, and there's no way of exploring that through science or other things. But then in all the other disciplines, we engage in discussion and try to come to truth. And even there, this radical freedom of speech that we talk about today at the universities, I really think that it's dangerous what we're saying, and that is that anybody ought to be able to say or do anything in a Catholic university. It's not a matter of censoring, but it's a matter of intentionality. Is the university trying to lead young people to truth? And so, does it make sense for a university to have someone come who denies the Holocaust to speak on campus? It doesn't, because we as a society have looked at the evidence and said, no, this is, it's okay maybe to explore that in the quiet realms of trying to look at the evidence and such, but in a public manner and with our students, we're not going to lead them from what is clearly accepted truth, and that is that this happened. You just don't do that. And so why would a Catholic university ever do that with regard to the most important truths that we assent to immediately out of faith, and there's no possible contradiction?
In your view, then, should university students at a Catholic university and professors and staff, everyone at the university, be sharing in a communal liturgical life?
Yes. Yes, and going back to the faculty thing, I think the ideal is 100% Catholic faculty. I mean, I can see situations where someone could really contribute who's not a Catholic, but ideally, everyone is assenting to that clear thing. And it, as we know as Catholics, it's not just what you intellectually assent to. It's what you live and what you witness to. Mm-hmm. And so that has to be part of the entire life of the institution, not just the students, but the faculty, the administration. Students ought to see, just as they do at a Catholic elementary school, they ought to see their teachers and their administrators and their coaches and other people participating in the Catholic life just as they are.
Mm-hmm. So I guess another watershed, if we're looking at this history now, for many people, and I don't know actually the full – I don't know the story myself, but I think many people would look at the revival at what happened at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, as the beginning of a new movement. Am I correct in saying that, or –
Somewhat. There were other things happening. I mean, so Thomas Aquinas College actually was established before that happened.
I see.
Thomas Aquinas was a direct response to Land O'Lakes.
Oh, to Land O'Lakes.
Actually, back in the 70s. Christendom College, Magdalen College, New Hampshire, Thomas More College. These were all new institutions that were established immediately recognizing that we need to get out of the old system and we just need to set up our own institutions because this is the only way we're going to really be able to live out this Catholic life, and they've done an amazing job of it. I was just up at Thomas Aquinas College for the day, and it's just beautiful and brilliant. And just everything that's happening there, it's just, you can really see the Holy Spirit working in that institution and in those students and the faculty. So that was happening, but a lot of people aren't even aware today because Steubenville has become such a sort of a model of really faithful, vibrant Catholic education. a lot of people aren't even aware that there was a turnaround. It was a party school. It was, the academics were poor. The campus was poor. I mean, everything about it was really a kind of a mess when Father Scanlon came in the 70s and really turned the place around. And he kind of had that opportunity because he had a, he was essentially given total, you know, carte blanche. You have the entire thing.
Fix it.
Because it's so bad.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want. You know,
right.
So sometimes it has to sink to the bottom before you have those opportunities. But he did. And what he did was just, I mean, I think God really was clearly working through him in that institution to set an example for the rest of us.
And so those institutions, whether they're Thomas Aquinas or Christendom, or you said Magdalen College in New Hampshire?
Yeah, it's now called Northeast Catholic. They've changed
the
name. Yep.
And then Steubenville as well. Do we have a split personality of the Catholic University in America now? Or I don't know, maybe that's not the right way to say it, but is that where we are now? We have two separate kinds of Catholic universities?
Sure. In the late 80s, early 90s, when I was at Fordham University as an undergrad, I was editor of the student newspaper and writing about these things. This is where I got into these issues. And, you know, a number of the Jesuits would say, we don't want to be a Franciscan University of Steubenville. Well, I had no idea what Franciscan University of Steubenville was at the time. And so I learned about it. But already they were reacting very strongly. We don't want to be that sort of place.
Do you have any sense of why? What was the argument against it?
Well, in Franciscan's case, I think part of it was because of the charismatic movement.
Oh,
right?
I see.
So there was
something
very unique about it, even in terms of its form of worship and everything.
Right.
But also it was just this sense that we are a legitimate academic institution.
Wow.
We don't allow that sort of religious fervor to dominate us, because that would make us less academic, and it certainly would make us less respected among other institutions. And so we would be doing a disservice to our students to not be fully integrated into the secular world of higher education.
I'm sorry to say this, but that sounds like our reputation is more valuable to us than...
It does. I think there's some legitimate... You know, there... some legitimate points, in the sense that there's no question that if you're not fully integrated into the full higher education realm,
yes,
because of their biases, not because of ours, then you do lose out on certain opportunities.
I can see
that, especially with graduate students and other things. And so you do have to make some choices. And so I think there's some reality there, but you know, at the very least, you sort of expect this from laity who are sort of half, you know, one foot in, one foot out sort of thing. These are the Jesuits. These are the shock troops of the Catholic Church, right? And this was their approach.
Yeah. So there's conscious decisions made there then. We're not going to be like those people over there, those odd people who kind of stick out. And they are odd. I mean, I don't mean that they're unusual,
right?
These smaller Catholic institutions. So, now, decades even after that, is there a reconsideration going on either in the smaller schools to say maybe we have been too provincial or something, or parochial, or is there any reevaluation going on in the bigger, older schools to say maybe we shouldn't have been so rash in rejecting what some of these smaller schools were doing?
Since Ex Corte Ecclesiae, there's been a lot of talk, and initially it was all window dressing. You know, it was all, hey, no, we comply with this, we do this. You know, for the institutions that were willing to even to say that, a lot were just simply refusing to suggest that they should comply with Ex Corte. But I do think that language conversation is powerful, right? And so even when you start to present yourself as something, you slowly, you know, start to become that thing. Right?
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And so we've certainly seen that even with the Newman Guide colleges. You know, we'll find an institution and we'll recommend them in our college guide, and you know, we'll feel that they meet the threshold. They're doing good stuff and they're solid and good institution. But it's wonderful to see how how every year they build on that and they become stronger and stronger and stronger. Every single, I don't exclude a single one of them. I mean, no institution is ever perfect. No person is ever perfect. And so they're always building on it. And that's very exciting.
So so you mentioned the Newman Guide. So let's, if we could, for just a second, talk about what the Cardinal Newman Society does and in how you hope to be a contributor to this revitalization of the Catholic identity of Catholic education.
Sure.
An identity which we have neglected to say, but I should say, is the most impressive intellectual history of anything right. in the world. I mean, you go back to the founding of the great medieval universities that became the basis for the formation of modern society as it is. I mean, the very roots of so many things that we see as good are a consequence of real and intellectually powerful Catholic higher education. So we want to restore that. We don't want to – I mean, we don't want to go backwards in time and recreate the medieval university or something, but restore that powerful intellectual and spiritual vibrancy. What's the contribution you hope to make with the Cardinal Newman Society?
Well, you know, so for – we're going on into our 25th year. You know, for most of that history, we were focused entirely on higher education. And, you know, what we found is, especially after we published the Newman Guide, really celebrating model Catholic institutions, that seemed to be the best way. For up till then, we were just being focused on being very critical and exposing problems at the other institutions, thinking naively that there would be a change because the bishops, laity would see this and would say, all right, we need to fix this. Not realizing that there was actually as much intentionality behind it, that this is actually who we need to be and we want to be.
Yeah.
So that makes it a much more difficult problem to address. And so we've been working on that, and the best way has been to hold up these models that are doing it really well. Over the next few years, I would like to be doing a lot more of now taking what we're seeing at those institutions, writing it up, having conferences, talking about best practices, and bringing in those people who are coming up in these other universities who really are interested in seeing how they can do things like the great, strong, faithful Catholic institutions. But the other thing is what we realized is that Catholic colleges and universities now not only, you know, maybe a lot of the changes happened because of the faculty and the people internally, but now, most Catholic families, that's what they want. They don't want the strong, faithful Catholic institution. They don't really understand why they would want that. You know, well, my kid's not going in the seminary.
This is
fine. And as long as they have Mass and as long as there's things that aren't too kooky, I'm okay with it. And I think that's such a shame because when I see what's coming out of these really faithful institutions like Steubenville and Thomas Aquinas and Christendom and these places, the transformation in the young people is unbelievable. They're all about formation of the person.
Right.
And the person really does change. Yeah. And the person really does change at these other institutions too, even if they're not intentionally trying to do that. And that's the shame of it, because it's usually not in a good way.
Yeah.
And so what we've been doing is we've now been delving down into K-12 education and doing a lot of work there because we now have a situation where most Catholic adults and most Catholic parents have not themselves ever experienced good, strong Catholic education, ever in their life.
Yes, right.
And so they don't know what it looks like, and they don't really know the great value and the treasure of it and the impact that it has. And so we're trying to get the stories out about these good schools, and we're reaching out to those people, especially in elementary and secondary education, to help them rediscover and appreciate what Catholic education does, which is so much more than simply, you know, happening to have the sacraments available while you go to school, right?
Yeah, amen.
Which is great in itself.
So, people can find out all about the Cardinal Newman Society at, am I correct, cardinalnewmansociety.org?
That's correct.
And Newman is N-E-W-M-A-N, cardinalnewmansociety.org. Patrick Riley is the president and founder of the Cardinal Newman Society. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
I feel like I've learned a great deal about it's such a... a winding road the last 50 years or so in Catholic higher education.
It is. It is. But I do think, I think these challenges come to us for a reason, and a lot of good is coming out of this.
Well, thank you for all you do, and thanks for being with us this hour. And thank you to all of our listeners. Thanks for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. You can always find us at catholic.com/focus. Would you please maybe post that on your social media somewhere and let other people know about what's going on here at Catholic Answers and Catholic Answers Focus in particular? We'll see you next time.